Okay, we're a couple days out from this interview, and I normally don't give a ton of context on these episodes. I kind of just like to let them roll and let them speak for themselves. But this I kind of want to talk about because this was a crazy interview for me. For people who know me, there probably isn't a guitar player that I look up to more than Brad Paisley, that I've spent more time trying to sound like, trying to learn his licks, and not even coming close, but trying so hard to get into the world of the Brad Paisley sound, the Brad Paisley tone, everything. This is crazy to me. I remember being in high school and my music theory teacher in 10th grade, maybe it was freshman year actually, he brought in, I remember the moment, he brought in a black Telecaster, he plugged it into an amp in our classroom where we should have been learning Bach chorales. He plugged it in and he played Eruption by Van Halen on a twangy black Telecaster. I said, that's the best sound I've ever heard. That heavy metal thing that he was doing with the single coil twang of a Tele, I thought was the best guitar tone I'd ever heard. It was absolutely insane to me. And he turned me on within probably the next couple days. He said, you should check out Brad Paisley. He started showing me videos. He started showing me licks. That sent me down a path. And it's crazy. I can't believe this happened. So we had a week to do this, to prep for it. His team reached out to me and said, do you want to interview Brad? We could do it next week. I jumped at the opportunity, and it was a crazy week because we were going to print with the second print issue for Nashville Briefing. And it was the day after we were supposed to go to print was this interview. So this was something that I normally would have wanted to have spent a lot of time to prep. And I had very little time to prep for this, but I kind of felt like, what else do I need to know about Brad? I've been doing prep for this my whole life. So put the print issue out, did the prep that I could in the time that I had, got into his house, set up. We recorded 90 minutes. You're about to hear it. And then what you're not going to hear is we ended up hanging out for hours after this conversation. We just stayed in his house and played guitars, talked about recordings, talked about amps. It was a crazy, crazy day. Eventually, I had to hop a flight to make it to a gig. Otherwise, I think I'd still be in his house, to be honest. It was so crazy. I can't even get into it. Okay. I don't even know what else to say. I got to roll into this right now. Here we go. We're going to kick it off. You're going to hear a little bit of playing, and we're going to get right into the interview. By the way, because I know some of the guitar players are going to ask, in this video, we're playing through an amp. We're going direct into this amp. The amp that we're playing into is called a Harmony 415, and it was Ken Fisher's favorite amp. Ken Fisher, of course, who built Trainwreck amplifiers. This was his amp. The one that we're playing is his personal amp that Brad now has, but the circuit was Ken's favorite amp circuit, apparently, according to Brad. And I bought one pretty recently, and I can personally tell you it's a pretty incredible amp. So if you dig the sound of this video, check that amp out, the Harmony 415. And that's all I got. Okay, here we go. We're rolling. Check it out.
But this one's insane.
But then, yeah, it's insane. There's something. And what's funny is the day I plugged it in, for the first time I went, don't touch it, to my tech. I said, don't touch it.
Don't do anything. This one just isn't.
I mean, you wouldn't think there'd be that much difference in.
It's actually insane what the difference is.
At all, especially this same year.
It's nuts.
Yeah.
They're like not even the same instrument.
No.
It's crazy.
The magic, and that's what Nacho told me. Like, Nacho's like, I've never loved 60s Teles. And he's like, that's the best guitar I think I've ever.
This is the one. Special.
Hey, watch it. What the hell? Look at him.
What are you talking about?
Fast forward to, him accepting, like, you know.
Do you know
his major award?
Do you know what's so hard about your records to learn?
Probably.
It is
for
so
me,
hard.
It's hard for me to learn it.
Is it hard to? Because every kid who spends endless time trying to learn your licks, it's hard to hear what's actually happening because you're listening to the steel, the piano, everything's in there. It's so hard to pick out exactly what you're doing. I feel like I never could get it. I'd sit there with my thing and
feel the
rewind.
Same way. It's like, I'll play it. I said this to, there's this great new kid named Hayden Baker that just released a I think it's an album or it's an EP. And I played on a song with an, it's a song called Don't Meet Your Heroes. And very true.
Yeah, I know. I was thinking that. I was thinking in my head, you said not me, yeah.
But that's why he named it that. And he, and it's kind of a, you know, nervous breakdown style.
Yeah.
And he even goes into the lick at one point. And I'm just testing him. I'm gonna throw out titles of guitar songs. But he sent me the track and I was like, yeah. So I played the middle solo thing and I saw him yesterday and he said, you know, I'm having one on your part and I don't, what did you do? I said, I have no idea. I was in the studio, I hit record. I was like, that's cool.
Yeah. Do you have
I'd have to learn it just the same way. It may take me longer than Hayden.
Do you have the isolated tracks anywhere? Like, mm-hmm. Could you go back into Mon the Tires and can you find the isolated tracks and really
figure
out what
you did? Well, it's been
a
while on that. That was 2-inch tape, so I don't even know. I mean, yeah, they exist, I'm sure, in stems, most likely.
Yeah.
But, like anything new, I have it in the computer.
Yeah, of course,
upstairs.
It's right there.
But yeah, sure. Like, that I would have. Like, what I played, I'd be like, okay, I could go listen to that.
Yeah.
If I had to.
So how do you, like, I saw a video once, this was years ago, I think you were putting little moments into the set, and there was a video of you literally with like a phone.
Learning that, yeah.
Was that a joke or was that real? Were you really
real.
Trying to figure out that solo?
The solo? Which I love that solo. I haven't played it in a night. I would say. You know, I can't remember now. But yeah, I had to learn like. You know what's funny? In the middle of a show, if we just call that song out, I can play it. I would name it.
It just comes to you.
Yeah, but sitting here, it's like...
You go, crap, I can't.
Slow it down? No, I can't.
You can't do it, no.
That's like nervous, slowed down.
It's weird, the lick doesn't make any sense slow down.
It doesn't.
It doesn't even sound good slow.
Yeah, as opposed to...
Then, there it is.
Yeah, it works.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, I have as much trouble as anybody else with that, and you know, let's be honest, I'm losing a step.
I want to ask you this story that's always blown my mind. When you were a kid, when you were 15 years old,
mm-hmm.
You tracked down 2 Vox amplifiers.
Yeah, well, with the help of, like, John Jorgensen, I had opened for the Desert Rose Band, and that's why I wanted it.
Because you saw him playing them.
Yeah.
And...
Well, and also, it was life-changing, because it was like... It was like, all right, that's tone. And this was in the 80s. This was like late 80s. And everybody else, it was, you know, the whole, it was like the whole, yeah. You know? Like Stratty kind of.
Yeah, right.
Chorus delay. Like up to that point, I had a Mesa Boogie preamp and an ADA.
Yeah, of course.
Chorus. Dual chorus stereo splitter with 2 Boogie cabinets. That was my rig.
Yeah.
Imagine that now.
It's crazy.
That's a cool rig now for certain things.
Yeah, right.
But, like, so then it was like, I heard, you know?
Yes.
And I was like, wow. That's a guitar, like, banging in an amp, and it's like, you know. You know?
Right.
That stuff.
The attack is so much more.
Yeah, I was, like, through a Vox AC-30, and I went. And also, when you saw, like, I opened for them, and there they were. It was like, he had a teal blue and a red when he opened for me. And for a while, he had a white one and a red one, and then he had a. And he had covered them himself. Like, he custom covered those amps because he had heard about. And he bought Tolex, ripped off the Tolex, and then put on this other stuff himself. Like, John's a tinkerer too.
Yeah.
And he really got these going, like a real, just a crazy, like, beautiful display of this guy with a sparkle finished ASAT playing this stuff. And I was like, that's what I want to sound like. And what's funny is I saw somebody in a chat room saying, where does Brad get his inspiration? They said, well, if you really want to figure out, like, what he's going for, go listen to Desert Rose Band, like John Jorgensen or the Helicasters.
Yes, yeah.
So
yeah.
They came back the next day, was like, man, he just absolutely ripped him off. Like, there's no originality to what I'm doing.
It's I don't think so, John. Though. I think your tone is very different, even through the Voxes.
Maybe. I can do an impression, but that's what happens with every guitarist and every songwriter and every the Beatles. It's you trying to be your heroes and you can't. And that becomes you.
Right.
Like it really does. Like when you think about like the Beatles were it was all just, you know, Chuck Berry. It was the, you know, Johnny B. Goode and
right, it was Keith Richards wanting to be Chuck Berry and
you know, roll over Beethoven and all of that.
Yeah.
And the Beatles were like, you know, I Wanna Hold Your Hand is that attempt at that and you know and then they were like, what happens if we take LSD?
Yeah.
And they became that. But it's like, in the case of me, I'm trying to be him or I'm trying to be, at times, you know, Steve Warner or Ricky Skaggs or, you know. But tone-wise, I went for John. I was like, okay, a Telecaster through an AC30 style amp, like a Dr. Z or a, is the sound I want.
And were you listening to those Brent Mason records in the 90s too? Like, was that part of it too? Or
sure, but that was a different thing. That was a little more of a... Yeah, Brent was more of a, like, a lot of what he played was through a Fender.
Yeah.
There's a sound to a Fender, and this is a Harmony amp that we're plugged in right here, but, like, there's a sound of a Fender that's that tighter, a little more compressed thing or something. Not compressed. What would you call it? You know what I mean?
I mean, I can hear,
it's scooped, you know.
To me, the Vox is a little tighter, I think, especially in the low end.
Well, Voxes have that mid-range, and then they go up in volume, and they're what they call Class A, which means they don't really, like, they don't just get to distortion. It just slowly becomes more and more harmonic. And then eventually you're like, oh, yeah, that's distorted. But until then, you didn't. And in that sense, it's got this really British thing that I loved, and it was, you know.
So I love picturing this, that you're calling London, basically, which is funny to think about because you couldn't, like, they didn't have them here. Well, now you could go into a Guitar Center and Voxes are everywhere.
Yeah, but they were way more prevalent over there. There were like Fender Twins over there. Yeah. Everybody had one in their basement.
Yeah.
So I call a store called Music Ground in Doncaster, England, because John had said, I had asked him, I got his phone number when I opened for them, and I called him, and I was here I am, like, 16, you know, 15, 16. I might have been 15 because I couldn't drive yet. My dad had to drive me to go pick them up when they came in because we saved money on the shipping by having them shipped locally an hour away and going there to pick them up.
Yeah.
Versus going all the way, like once they landed in America, the ground shipping even an hour south was like...
So you drove to pick them up, and TSA had torn the boxes open, right?
You know all this.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, no, we got there, and they searched them for drugs.
Yeah.
Which...
Because they thought guitar amps coming in, probably someone's trying to smuggle drugs in them.
This is a backdoor operation. There's cocaine in these.
And then how'd you plug both of them in together? Were you able to...
Well, when I got them home, they had British plugs. They had the big thing with the three prongs that... So I was like, that was funny because I had borrowed $2,500 from my dad. I was good for it because around that time of year, I was really playing. It was Christmas-ish.
Yeah.
And I was playing a lot of solo gigs and making a couple $100 every time.
And he knew where you lived.
Yeah, he knew where I lived.
Right.
He was my landlord.
Right.
So same guy that owned that paddle right there, which is going to be...
That's going to be our next...
That's our next story.
Yeah, okay, great.
But... So John Jorgensen says, go find them wherever you can find them. So I call these places. They send them to town. It's two amps. I've never even played through an AC30 at this point, and I've just spent $2,500 to
on
ship them from England to someone I could barely understand on the phone. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Calling at weird hours. So they get there. We drive up. We get them. We drive an hour back through snow coming down. We get to within... My dad was a president of the fire department, volunteer fire department. We get to within walking distance of the house. We're 500 yards away, but we're going down the main drag, and he says, we need to wash the truck. And so there's two AC30s and cardboard boxes in the back of...
Why does he say that? He's totally screwing with you, right?
He's being him.
Why
is he
doing that?
If you've ever met him, you understand. So he's just teaching me a lesson, which he still does.
Yeah. We're going to get to the paddle next.
Oh, yeah. So we pull in. So he's like, we have to wash the truck. And I'm like, what? And by now it's like 8 o'clock at night, right?
Yeah.
So we pull into the stall in the fire department where firefighters could wash their cars. There was the wash stall. So he gets out and he's like, help me. And I'm like helping him wash the car. And I could see the amps in the Chevy Blazer in the back.
Yeah.
So we wash it. We get all the salt off. He's like, we got to detail the rims. I mean, it is like
the whole thing.
The biggest wash job. So we get back in the car. We go home. And then we pull into the driveway. I'm like, let's get them. So we haul them out. And by now, it's like 9:30 at night, like 9 o'clock. It's starting to get a little late to like play loud because we do have neighbors. So
yeah.
We're putting the amp in the house. I get them out. I set them up. There they are. I'm like, look at them. They're beautiful. It's that. I've still got the one of them is still in there.
What happened to the other one?
The other one was not, didn't really work, and I ended up trading it for something. Eventually.
Okay, so you have them both set up.
Have them both set up. So, yeah, so there they are, and I go to plug them in the wall, and they're British plugs.
Right.
So now we got to run down, we call, they've just closed Radio Shack, because we need an outlet to, like, solder it on, and then we call somebody else, and they get me another plug, so we wire that up, and it's about 10:30 at night, and the lady next door, Mrs. Sarah, is going to sleep. She's about 80. And I'm like, he's like, don't like. So I literally plug it in the wall, and I go, I go like. Right? To hear
that's
it?
That's it.
Blow a fuse.
No.
One of the amps blew a fuse the second I plugged it in. So that's the weirdest little fuse. I had to find it. So it was the next day before I really got to play them.
And then did you play them together? How'd you wire them so they were playing together? Yeah. Or were you playing them separate?
I split it through a stereo splitter.
So like you just got a stereo
pedal,
splitter. You had one ready to go.
I was ready to go. I wanted to hear both amps.
And did it sound like you thought it would in your head?
Yep.
And is that, to me, that's the tone probably that you've been chasing your whole career.
Without a doubt. Because
without
that,
a doubt.
That became long sermon. That became, you know, text. You know that.
That's totally that sound.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so that's long sermon.
Mm-hmm. This guy knows.
How come that's on the set right now? That hasn't been the set.
It was never a single.
It was never a single.
We always play it in Europe because they don't know the difference.
They're
like everything. Like they never had radio, so they're like, why didn't you play Harvey Bodine? It's like,
that's a fun song. There's just a trombone on there, or a tuba on that song.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But they, over there, you get away with, I can do it. I've thrown it in. I mean, it's fun. People don't hate it.
I think there should be a moment in your set where you throw in one totally deep cut.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought about that?
Yeah.
What would you throw in?
Well, it depends on the night, like what I'm in the mood for. We've thrown Me Neither in lately.
Okay, that's a good
one. Fun.
Off the first.
What's so funny is my oldest son the other day, Huck, said, man, I was listening to Me Neither. What a cool song, Dad. And I'm like, who are you? Like, when did this happen? You thought, but he like appreciated the humor of it finally. But you know what he said? I don't like the ending. I said, what do you mean? Don't you think it's time for me to end this song?
Me neither,
you know.
That's a great ending. Is there anything?
What's that?
Is there anything? We gotta talk about with this guitar that you're holding too. Is there anything? Because your kid is about how old you were when you got these Vox amps. Is there anything that either one of your kids? Is there any excitement that you see when they get anything?
Yeah.
Like this,
like
what do they want that you then see yourselves in them getting these
Vox
amps?
They're watching the acquisition of like this, which we'll talk about this in a bit. This magical unicorn that I'm holding.
Yeah.
And they have their equivalents. Like for my oldest, it's things like there's comic books, and the nostalgia of like that world for him, you know, he's down the rabbit hole of that. Like he really, and there's also things like he's way into art. Like he loves things like really cool artists like Banksy and like, you know, and like he's into some of that. And then my, like Jasper is a little more into like building and stuff. Like he invents things all the time. He's way into Legos. He's like, his pandemic was spent
doing Legos,
like with sores on his hands from,
yeah,
you know, building every Lego he could afford. And then, but they collect things like that. And as far as like old stuff, like musically, they're not like, they each play the piano. Huck's really pretty good at it, but that's probably not what, I don't know what they're going to do, but that's probably not what they're going
to
do.
Yeah. But have you seen a moment of excitement in their eyes that's equivalent to how you felt bringing those Vox amps home?
Yeah, for...
Because I want to know if you screwed with them the way your dad screwed with you, stopping at the fire station.
Yeah, I don't know that I'm like that, but I'm a little more... Their mom's maybe more like that. I'm a little... She's more like... She's like, that's great. I'm so glad you finally got that. You have to clean the kitchen.
Though. Yeah, right. Before.
Yeah, you can't get that out until you've cleaned the table and whatever. That. Right. Me, I'm the one that's like, oh, my mom.
Right. Yeah.
You know? And she, that drives her nuts, too, that I'm a little more like them.
Right. I get it. That makes sense.
Skips a generation, maybe.
Yeah, it skips a generation. That's exactly right. We got to talk about these guitars. First of all, I was so jealous growing up that there wasn't a guitar that I could play that would be my signature guitar, the way Paisley guitars.
It's Kuhn?
Kuhn,
like John,
yeah.
Like John Kuhn from the Packers?
Yeah, he's my uncle.
No.
Yeah.
He's not. No. I was going to say.
It's like that, but it's not like that. Yeah.
Okay.
But there was no Kuhn signature guitar.
You can do a raccoon.
I should have done that.
Yeah, the Kuhn. You know South Park? The
yes.
Coon? You know
Coon?
The superhero? The
yes,
Coon?
Yeah. That's I should have had Cartman, that on the
Cartman
guitar.
Cartman superhero, the Coon.
Maybe I should get a sticker on that for the guitar.
You for, totally should.
For a guitar.
Without a doubt.
Okay, I'm so glad we cleared this up.
Yeah.
But your first Paisley, you bought with advance money, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah. That was, I don't know if it was I think it was like they just gave me the money for it. I had gotten a deal with publisher and a production deal and was working on stuff, and I was like, that was like 95. And I was like, I'm gonna go buy a Paisley Telly. And they're like, well, we have a budget for stuff like wardrobe and that kind of counts. And I'm like, well, if you're willing to, yeah, sure. I mean, if their money, great.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it was nothing. It was like $3,000 then.
It's crazy, right?
Which now, I mean.
So that was your first pink Paisley.
Yeah.
And then what was the next one that you got of the Paisleys? It was this La Brea one.
Mm-hmm.
And then where are we now? So this one, when did you get this one that you're holding?
Kind of last year, at the end of the year, sort of, beginning of this.
And was your obsession with this color, did it only start when you got this
guitar? Well, the bottom line is, like, they made red... They called it Paisley Red. There's a great ad that we can show. I'll show you. It's on my phone. But did you ever see the ad for it?
I don't know if I ever have.
It's, like, so cool. It basically says, like, Paisley Red. I'll read you the ad and show you what it looks like. Like, this was so stupid.
Were they red
This, by
originally?
The way, was a really dumb business decision by Fender.
Were they more red originally, and then did they become more pink?
Yeah.
Or were they always like this?
I think
this?
They were always pink-ish, see? That's what the ad looked like.
Oh, yeah. That's
I'll send
so
you that
fun.
If you
send
wanna...
me that. We'll overlay.
Yeah. Basically, it's this ad here. And it says this. Like, if you read the print, it says Paisley Red. This is so stupid. Paisley Red pulsates with every beat and swirls in a blinding carousel of color, forms, and tones. Fender shines again. This was going to rejuvenate them. And there's the bass, too.
That's so
they
fun.
The Paisley bass.
Because this is kind of a weird time for Fender.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
CBS now in 67 they're fully owned.
Yeah,
by
it was
CBS.
A weird time for America. It
yes.
was, everything
yeah, yeah,
was
yeah.
weird, you know. And it was like they're like, "Oh man, let's put this so this stuff was called cling foil that's on these, right? As my phone starts to make the
to make the yeah, yeah.
do that thing it does. Cling foil was this stuff. Like look at this. This is crazy. Here's an ad for cling foil and it's got a woman in her living room. Yeah.
I mean, this is so funny.
Look at this. You can put that up too. Cling foil, the sparkling new self-stick decorative foil covering. And it's got like, there. She's covered everything in that room has it.
Has cling foil.
The fridge has cling foil.
Basically what they're saying is put this everywhere.
Yeah.
It's going to go on everything.
Yeah, the flower pot looks like it's got the red probably. But we think that was called pink. I don't know. But anyway, they go into the lab, whatever that was, and go, some guy shows up, some hippie got hired by Fender, and had a brilliant idea. Let's stick that adhesive foil paper on these, on guitar bodies, and we can charge a premium, and they'll buy it. Because everybody wanted, because you saw, I mean, you've seen the Brady Bunch and Partridge Family, that's what they wanted.
Yeah, that.
Look at their house.
Yeah.
And so it was like that, and then nobody liked it. Like, it was, I mean, if you look at this, like, it's the
thing
weirdest.
That's weird is it doesn't look bad to me, but I think that's because we've accepted them.
For sure.
But it doesn't look bad to me.
So here's what happens. They put these out, it's 1968 when they released them, right? And this comes out as well as Blue Floral, which is in the other room, which we can show people to later. But like, so these come out and it's like, you saw the ad. It's like at Paul Saitz, congratulations. And everybody's kind of like, that's the ugliest thing I've ever seen. And it would be, it's sort of red paisleys with a pink interior and green. And then this red burst that turns gold immediately when the sun hits it. Like, if you look at look at my first album cover, or not cover, but inside the art, look at what old pink looks like. It was still red on the, it still had red. It is now 100% copper. Like, all that red evaporates immediately in the sunlight. That old pigment doesn't hold up. And so, like, everybody's thinking, oh, that's the stupidest idea ever. And by the way, it was another $100 like to get that version versus a regular telly. So they sat on the shelves. Everybody's like, I'll take the one that's $100 less that's actually pretty to me. So they send one to James Burton and go, maybe he'll do it. You know, he'll love this. So James sees it, and James has told the story, and it's great. And he's like looking at it in the case, and he's like, am I really gonna play this? And so he puts it off for a few days. And then one night at the Hilton in Las Vegas, I think, he's got on his white jumpsuit, everybody does, and Elvis is ready to go. And he goes, watch this. He puts it on, da-da-da, da-da-da, right? Elvis looks and stares at him the whole night. And then James goes over when it's over, and he's like, oh man, I'm dead. Because the thing is popping from the stage unlike any instrument. And look at it, you know, and so he says, boss, I'm sorry. I won't ever do it again. And he goes, oh, no, you'll never play anything else. That's amazing. That. And because Elvis loved it, Elvis had said, you're right, that's ugly, don't do that,
we'd never hear about them probably.
They'd all have been destroyed. And instead, here's James Burton gets known for that guitar. And I told James, you're the reason I didn't have to change my name.
Are you serious? Deal. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No, yeah, like, right.
But I told Fender, I thanked him when I first talked to him and started doing stuff with him. I was like, you made me a SIG model 4 years before I was born.
Yeah, right. It's incredible. So then what's the obsession now with these? So you finally get this one about a year ago.
So they made, cling foil, this substance did not also, I don't think it sold well either. Like, I think they had it on rolls in the shelves.
The whole thing is just a failure.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways. Like, and they had many, like, there's other flower patterns, there were stripes, there were some big square blocks, but it's all aluminum foil with adhesive, and it's got a pressed sort of pattern to it, and it's a really pretty thing. When you look at it, it's 3D. Like, these paisleys look like they're floating on this.
Yeah.
So the thing that's crazy about this is that they went with that. And so I'd always thought, why that color? And did they mock up anything else? And so we were on this quest for a long time to see, like, could this exist? And here it is. And so this is a 67. This is, we call it the Lost Paisley. It is, you know, it's crazy to me that this isn't the one that they decided to go. Like, when they see these, why is this a unicorn? That ought to be the unicorn.
Yes, right.
It ought to be reversed, because to me, this is so much, it might have even worked in this color.
This one is such a great color.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's, and what's crazy is, like, this, I don't know how many they would have done of other colors.
How many do you think these exist?
I don't know.
No idea.
No idea.
So then how do you start meddling with this? to try to figure out.
We've been on a hunt for this, and it's funny. You saw some of the ads that I did, or yes. Not ads. I say ads. It's me doing stupid Instagram videos.
No, they're great.
With incredible technology.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Incredible special effects.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's amazing.
You
Spielberg
really thought I was
going
to die, didn't you?
I did. And what's interesting is you put Zach in the role of the character who gets stabbed by
yeah,
the
you
want to
do
traps.
That next time? I
I'll
can always
here.
Use a great Zach
yeah, yeah.
sidekick.
I'm here. Say the word. Yeah, yeah.
One of
absolutely.
My favorite comments was, isn't he a little tall to be short round?
Right, right.
But like, yeah, I said, because I wanted people to know about this as I started to, I played in Europe and started to get questions like, what is that? And so I was like, we should do a funny reveal of this thing that is really to me, this, and you've played it, it's special.
This guitar is insane. And the difference between the pink one and this one, which are...
And that's a great guitar.
Killer guitar.
But how does a great guitar get bested by such a degree? I don't know. And I've recorded with this lately on some things and it's like, what? And in the studio, it's the same thing. It's like, just, I don't know, it speaks.
It just comes to life.
Yeah, but this is the fun part. My wife is so over this. She is so like, I'm so done with this. You know, and I've got some other friends that we've been like talking about, like, what do you do with this? And how do we let people sort of like share in this thing? And we're working on that, but it's like, as she walks by and we're on the phone, she's like, if I talked about anything this much, you would probably leave me.
Maybe.
Yeah.
And is there anything else you say about these guitars?
Man, I just think coming to a city near you, right?
Coming to a city near you,
yeah, and also, like, we are trying to, like, figure out, like, how do other people get to experience this? But.
It's yeah. incredible.
But yeah, I think it's just fun to like, what's neat about this is like, as somebody with a namesake of that, when I wasn't around when they did all that, to have sort of discovered this potential thing that could be like, I think there's a legacy thing to this a little bit, you know? Expanding on what was a really bad idea and taking it further, you know?
It's so funny though, because I feel like it's a good idea.
I'm the type to take a bad idea as far as you can take it.
To take it as far as you can take it.
To yeah, run yeah, it yeah. in the ground.
It's incredible. I want to ask you too, so going back to the start of your career a little bit, you started working, there's a Shelley Wright record that I love.
Oh
you,
yeah.
That you wrote like a couple, three songs on it or a handful of songs.
Right.
And produced the songs.
Produces relative.
Is your band on that record?
Maybe. Usually, if you see me involved in something, they're usually in there. If I can get them in there, they're in there.
Yeah. To me, I wanted to ask, I think this record came out in 2001.
Yeah, maybe.
And I feel like at that time, your career as a country superstar was maybe not as set in stone as it became with the next record
and
the record.
It doesn't feel set in stone to me yet.
What do you mean? That's but that's a line, right? You have to feel like your place in country music is cemented.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know.
Okay, but here's my point. Working on that record, were you working on that record as a songwriter and producer thinking, I don't know if my country career is going to work, so I might as well?
No.
That wasn't what that record was about, working on
I
that
never
record.
Wanted to be a producer at all.
Really?
And I'm really not.
Yeah.
I'm terrible at it.
Why do you think so?
Because it is a lot of organization and a talent for dealing with people. I can deal with people, but I'm better as a, I think I'm better as like a boss or a collaborator than I am a sort of like creative, like bring everybody in. And like, I've got one of my best friends is John Lasseter from Pixar that started Pixar. He's now a Skydance. And that's a man that can take something that's the biggest, most moving parts you've ever seen and then create something that you're sitting there crying when it's done and it feels like everything was done by one mind. I think the best producers do that. The best producers bring in all of these people and get the best out of them. I'm better at sort of having total control, I think. And in that sense, that's why I don't really, like, I don't produce my own records that much. Sometimes I get co-production credit if it's necessary or if it really is warranted, but I'd rather not. Like,
Yeah.
I always, I'm way happier to play guitar for someone and co-write and then sing with them. And then, you know, if that leads to you're getting production credit, I don't care.
So was that a record that you were working on because someone said, hey, maybe you should go write some songs with
her? We were writing, that's all.
Oh, so you were just writing it and just worked on the record.
Yeah, and the next thing you know,
yeah.
It was that.
How was Stagecoach a couple weeks ago?
I loved it.
Really?
Yeah, it was like, it was so much fun to see. I've gotten to know Post really well. And he had asked me, like, last year I went and hung out with him for the first time, got to know him. There's a lot there. Like, our friendship began, it's an old friendship immediately. Like, I was his first concert. He went and saw me when he was 6 years old in Darien Lakes, New York, is what he told me, with his dad. And so there's like, you know, he's, I keep reminding myself, it's like, oh, he's like, he's young, because he seems so much more mature than that. But when we first started hanging out and we started working on some musical things that we'll start, you'll see eventually, that we're doing, you know, he right away was like, you know, I think I'm gonna play Stagecoach. Will you play? And I said, yeah, I'm there. So that began, that was one of the first conversations we ever had. It was like, he's like, seriously? And I said, yeah, no, I'm there, I'll do it. That sounds fun. And what was really neat was seeing, and I said this I posted this, that he belongs here. And I think
what
he
do
does.
You mean by that? I think you're right, but what does that mean?
For me, it's that I've never seen anybody that knows, like he knows as much as you or I about the history of this stuff. Like when you're sitting here and I start long sermon, he knows that too. Like when he'll say, you know, he'll bring up an obscure thing. And when it comes to like, you know, like when Toby Keith passed away, he knows everything about Toby. Like when you know, like he is so capable, like he doesn't need the words at karaoke for anything that was on the country charts from 90s on. I mean, he knows it. He's a student of it. And in that sense, like, he's a student of a lot of things, and he mastered the pop hip hop world. And it's like, that to then say, okay, what happens when I put my toe in this water? It's gonna be interesting.
Did you guys rehearse for that, or did you just show up and wing it?
I was there 2 hours before, and
2 hours before, and
knew what we were gonna play. And
he gave you the set list, and yeah. His band sounded good, actually, didn't they?
They were a bunch of session players, great players. Yeah.
Yeah. That's crazy.
You know, and he put together the set list, and I even said, like, what do you want to do? And he had originally said, I think maybe I'll do Ticks. I'm like, do Ticks. And then he was like, nah, I got to do I'm Gonna Miss Her, because that's the one that he's getting known for doing.
Yeah.
You know, he's done it a few times and put out a little version of it now. And I was like, well, do that. It's fine. And he's like, well, I was thinking about maybe a Vince song. And I was like, well, I'll play that. And then he's like, Chattahoochee. I was like, I'll play that. I know him. I even told him, I said, don't bring me out and then expect me to, like, go home. I'm going to stay there and play some songs.
Do you ever
find... If I'm setting the rig up,
we're going to play. We're going to do it. And you guys jammed for
it was great.
A couple songs.
Yeah, it was great to see the reaction. I think he was emotional over the love he felt. And everybody loved it. Like, it was so cool that he did these covers. And he's doing this the right way. He's immersed himself in our town.
It's a great set. It's amazing.
It's fun, and it's so much fun to vicariously watch this guy who comes at it like he's a new artist again.
Yeah. Do you ever find yourself in a situation, in a crowd, where you could play someone the Fishing Song for the first time? Is there any room where no one's ever heard it, and you get to experience that reaction from them?
For sure, every now and then. Yeah, no.
What is that? Is that like a super corporate setting,
I was playing a thing at the White House for all the governors and some of Congress, and here's like a cross section, and you know, it was so funny because the red state governors knew what was coming,
right?
The blue state governors did not.
Right. You know what
I mean? It was hilarious. It was like, oh, you're not a fan. When you're laughing at that, it's like, thanks for laughing, but...
That was the giveaway that you're not a fan, because if you were a fan, you would know that song.
Yeah, they're like, you know, when you see the elbow going,
yeah.
How about that?
And do any of those people come up to you before and they say, Brad, just want to say I'm a huge fan, I love all your music, and then you see them laughing and you go, caught you, you're not a fan?
Well, that's like the woman the other day that's like, I think you're amazing and I love your duet with Morgan Wallen.
No, someone said that to you?
Yeah, I was like, thanks.
Thanks, yeah.
Appreciate that. Have you been a fan a long time? Long time.
And then plays the fishing song, starts laughing. That's right. That's the giveaway. Do you find, something I've always been fascinated about you is you seem to appeal to both sides of the aisle where you'll go, you've talked about flying, you know, with Obama, and then you'll hang out with the Bushes.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something about you that you think both sides of the aisle can come together on and agree with? Is it just the music?
I would hope so. That would be the goal. That would totally be the goal. I hope so. I mean, I just would have no appeal of just, or no desire to be just like, I only want a certain group that are just like me. And because, by the way, I don't even know where I fall on half the stuff. It's like, to me, it's like we're all collectively, especially in a concert. And that's why it's like you never want to get political in a concert if you can help it. I mean, there's sometimes you need to speak up, obviously, but especially think about a summer outdoor concert. I mean, I'm there to sing I'm Gonna Miss Her and Water and Mud on the Tires and Then She's Everything and Whiskey Lullaby. And I mean, and that's what they came for. And I hope whoever you are, you feel comfortable there, wherever you stand, you know?
Yeah.
Because we, again, country music should really be the thing that unites in a great way, because it's all about like telling real stories, you know? And it's one thing to make a point that maybe not everyone agrees with in a song, but it should be a collective experience to like, you know, unite.
Right, absolutely.
It's so funny because I wore a Unity t-shirt at one of the CMAs and Chris Stapleton came up afterwards and he's like, you realize your guitar strap hid the Y your whole performance. I was like, so I was basically out there and it said unit. The whole time. Unit.
That'll do it.
Great. Yeah, great. That was what I was going for.
That was exactly it. Mm-hmm. Here's something I've always been curious about. So you took guitar lessons at one point in your career from a guy named Roger Horde.
Roger's amazing. Yes.
What did you not have that you learned from him or that you went to him to try to learn on the guitar?
Roger, everything. Like when it comes to like, I think the things you learn on the guitar that are the most important, you teach yourself. Like the basics, like that comes from sitting and whittling away at, you know, just figuring out like your scales and then figuring out like what's your, that comes from sitting.
Where'd you learn that? From Buck That's, Owens? From
I
Don
guess,
Rich?
Yeah, James Burton.
Or James
Always
Burton.
Always goes back to James.
Yeah.
So, but Roger was the type that, Roger was such a student and such a monster. Like, Roger would be like, I would say, I want to learn Yankee Doodle Dixie, the Chet thing.
Yeah, which right.
Which is... And
then on top. Yeah.
Anyway, I haven't played in a while. But Roger's the type, it's like, sure, I'll tab that out for you. And you could, like, he knows
he
everything.
He knew it.
He knew everything. Lenny Bro stuff, like, he knew all of the stuff that's the, like, all of the Chet things that I was working on, you know, the... You know, just things that you want to... Finger style, jazz, anything.
How would he break it down to you, like, when you think about jazz, because some of your licks that you play are very jazzy.
Totally.
What are you thinking about? Are you thinking about the triads? Are you thinking about the scales, or the chords? Are you that in depth with it? Like, how do you end up finding those other notes?
It becomes second nature. Like when you take a guy like Red Volkart.
Yeah, who played your wedding.
Played my wedding.
Yeah.
I love Red. But, you know, Red will do like, you know, he'll do like a whole tone scale. And it's like you got the... You know, like what note creates that tension that is then resolved? And that's actually one thing my kids are into that is... like going back to the things they're collecting, old vinyl.
Really?
Like Wes Montgomery. And like,
how cool is that?
Like, Al Green is Jasper's favorite. Like he's buying all the old like soul records and stuff that he, and B.B. King. And I got him a live album from BB the other day, that, and they're flipped out that I even recorded and got to know BB. And it's a shame they didn't get to meet him, but like, you know, but it's that thing about jazz, you learn these scales and then you figure out like, how does that do something? Like the next thing you know, you're playing your typical thing, but if you throw in a note that shouldn't be there, how's it resolved? You know?
Right.
And you want that to resolve, and you find a, you know.
So is that the kind of things that Roger was teaching you?
Or a
was
little
it
bit.
Mostly
he would say, learn this scale, learn that scale, figure out that solo over top of these chords.
Right.
Then I took jazz at Belmont and got a D in it.
Is there anything you learned in that class that you bring into your playing?
Yes. Marty Crum was he was great at that, but I kept kind of like skipping class and I ended up with a D and my dad was going to kill me. That's the paddle comes into the story in a minute.
I haven't forgotten about the paddle, trust me.
He wanted to use it again.
He wanted to use it again there.
Oh, for sure. A D in guitar, they're paying money.
That's why you're going there.
I moved to Nashville to be a guitar player, singer, songwriter, go to Belmont. I get A's, B's, C's, and everything else, and a D in guitar.
Because this is a story that gets brought up in a lot of interviews.
Yeah, I like talking about it because it's kind of funny.
I don't understand. Like, I went to music school too. The classes I got A's in were guitars because I love learning the guitar, which I'm sure you do too.
Mm-hmm.
What was happening in this guitar class that you actually end up getting a D?
I just wasn't showing up.
I missed
a bunch.
Did you think you were better than everyone else? Like, is that why you weren't
showing up? No, it was one-on-one guitar.
Oh, it was a private lesson, basically.
Yeah, and I was like, it was for credit. And he gave me a D. He was like, you missed like most of the classes this semester. And I deserved it. And I was learning things, but I also was busy. Like I was really working hard in Nashville. And I also had gigs already. And
so to you, it was like, what am I?
What am I going to get? That's here? The one that was going. And then it cost me. So I went in and I said, my mother's going to lose her mind. She's a school teacher. And if I don't get this changed from a D to something, is there anything I can do? And he said, if you don't miss another class this next semester, I will change this now. If you promise me you're going to be there every time, I'll make it a C. I said, deal. And he said, and I have a gig this weekend. He was a great jazz player. He said, but I'm playing country and I'm borrowing a telly. And he's like, and you have to show me some things. And I said,
no way. That's
I said, deal. And so we sat down and he was playing like.
And what'd you show him?
Like, you know. You know what I mean?
Yes.
You know what I mean?
That
stuff. It was like, okay, so here's what Brent's doing, you know.
So that was, and then he got you, he passed the class basically, or he got you a C.
I changed it to a C, which saved a little bit of the average.
From that.
It kept my average in the twos.
And then when you also at Belmont, when you spend so much time in the studio and when you go in late at night and with Frank,
so
right? And you would.
Yeah, me and my producer, Frank Rogers, and Doug Sadler, a great engineer, and my couple band guys, and it was free studio access, but the hours were like, it was like they shut the thing down at like 9 at night or 10 maybe. And so Doug was studio manager, so he would engineer, and then we would stay in there until they kicked us out, and then we would literally pretend to lock up. You know, they didn't have any cameras or anything yet. So we'd lock ourselves in, and we would record, but we couldn't get out because everything locked. So we'd be in there, we'd get food and drinks and stay, and then be there till 6 a.m., and then at 6 a.m. we'd start to load out before everybody showed up.
Right.
One
Brilliant.
Time Bob Malloy, the head of the school, was coming in the morning about 7:30, and we're like sticking the speakers that we used back in the storage cabinet.
Yeah.
And we're walking, like holding these big like woofer speakers into the cabinet, and around the corner comes Bob, and it's me and I think James Gregory, the bass player that I was with, and he comes around the corner, and we're going in and loading in like to put everything away from. And we came and started to back out again as if, and he's like, setting up early. Good job, boys.
Right.
Early bird
Brilliant.
Gets the worm.
So basically, he came in, you said, shit, we're packing up. You said, let's just set up.
If he had looked close, we looked like we'd been up all night.
But exactly right. And do you think that time in there in the studio, was that where do you feel like you got the sound for that first record? Who needs
Absolutely,
pictures?
Because I remember I had some of these songs. Like, and I remember, like, because we had this thing where we cut everything too slow for a while.
And what do you mean, like tempo-wise?
Oh, yes.
Like, yeah.
Like, We Danced was originally like... Bar was empty, you know?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
I was sweet, and I was so slow. It's like, you'll never get that played on the radio with that tempo. And but we, what we found is we were working on, like, how do you nail something that's sort of like, and we that perfect quarter note.
Everyone being even, which is so hard.
Yeah. And we were like, the drums are like, and long before you could quantize everything in a computer.
Right, you needed to be perfect.
Yeah.
So that was it. And isn't it weird? I've always heard that the label, they didn't want you to play guitars on the record.
I don't know. Now I forget all that. But they were good. I wanted Frank to produce. He was a student with me. I wanted to use my band. They definitely didn't want that. And I was like, but that's what I want to be. I want to be like these guys, Merle and Buck, especially Buck. Buck did what he wanted.
Right.
You know, and so it was like that. It was like, let's go in and make something nobody's making, you know. So they said, we'll go in and cut 4 songs and we'll see how they go. And they gave us the budget to cut 4 songs. And they were, and we went in and cut 4. First 4, turned them in, played them for them. And I think we blew them away. It was Long Sermon, We Danced, Who Needs Pictures, and Me Neither. Those were the first 4 we cut. And those are the record. Like, we didn't touch them. That was it. That's what you hear. And they said, okay, you can do the rest of the record.
That's what sold it to them.
Yeah, for sure.
Were you in the early days, I mean, you've got one of the best bands in country music.
I would think so. I think those guys are completely underrated and overlooked. The guys that have played with me, there's a reason we've been together this long and nobody's left.
And were they that good when you found them? Is that why? No. But why were you so loyal to them?
Neither was I.
But why were you so loyal to them? Were they amazing players, or was the idea of just having a band really cool?
My drummer is the key. His name's Ben Caesar. He's played every record since the second. That was when he came along. He's unbelievable. He's like this guy that grew up playing rock and jazz and has the sensibility. He's Berkeley trained. That's to say, like, Berkeley trained means nothing in the sense of feel. Like, they can't teach you feel. He just, like, I've never felt as in the pocket as I have with him. Like, he nails what he does. And he's really meticulous, too. I mean, when you think about something like Time Warp, what's going on drum-wise in that, the jazz stuff.
He's so steady.
And the speed of that, the... Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
And then he goes into the jazz stuff, and he can do all that. It's rare.
Yeah.
You know, he's the one that he's had stomach flu before and played the show, thankfully, and was just thrown up between songs.
Who do you get to replace? What happens if he...
I have no idea. He's the irreplaceable. He's the, like, don't have a heart attack.
He's like your Don Rich, kind of.
I would say that's true. Because you could piece together other things and have. Like, we've had shows where, you know, one band member had to miss for whatever reason or another. Almost everyone except, well, even bass. And we got through it.
Yeah.
But I don't know that a drummer sits down and plays that show.
So were you loyal to these guys because you thought the idea of having a band was really cool? Or was it like you're saying that Ben was just such a monster drummer?
No,
you couldn't imagine having to do it.
And again, he hadn't played country. When he auditioned for me, he'd played like a couple of gigs of country. But I could see in him, I was like, this guy's got the thing I want, which is he's going to bring, because I knew I was not always just going to do, you know, and we dance.
Right.
You know.
You had some rock in you. So
yeah, there was always going to be the nervous breakdown. And then it was going to be like, what else are we going to do? Ticks and what?
Right.
Something crazy like, you know, even Beat the Summer or whatever it might be, where it's like interesting grooves, and I knew he could hang The rest of them, I like loyalty. I enjoy the fact that we're friends first. I don't want to lose people if I can help it. I, you know, inevitably in this career, things turn over. You don't end up with all of the people you started with, but, and sometimes it ends bad, sometimes it ends great, but it ends. But the fact that these guys, like I make the joke, I've been making the joke in concert and said this in Europe. I was like, gonna have to cut these guys a break. They're new and they're making a lot of mistakes tonight because of that. But let's hear it. I mean, and everybody's like, sympathetic applause. It's like, you know, they've only been with me since 2000.
2000.
Maybe 2001. The new guy's the steel player. He started in 2001.
Randall. Yeah.
2001.
He's the new guy.
Still getting hazed. Yeah.
Yep.
Wedgies.
You know. I saw you play this show once. I don't even know if you remember. It was a country music festival in New York. Horrible idea at the time.
That thing? You were the thing in what?
Yes.
The one in the rain?
Yes.
Good Lord. That thing was what a horrible idea.
So I was trying to remember. Did I remember this correctly? So I was watching videos of it last night on YouTube.
There's still videos of that?
Yeah. And I remembered
That's
correctly.
That's the problem with YouTube.
It's all out
this
there.
This is all going to be there forever too, isn't
this,
it?
This probably. So in that, so it was raining and something on your guitar wasn't working. You played like half the show without a guitar. You were just holding a mic, walking around as a front man. Is that the only time you've ever done that?
No, I've done that before. I mean, maybe that was because the guitar broke.
That's what happened.
Yeah. I mean, it was raining so hard.
Right.
I don't know how we kept those together. How they even didn't come apart.
And what was crazy about that show was all your guitar solos.
Yes.
When they'd kick in, you would just say, Randall, take, like you would kick it off to your steel player, your fiddle player. And I felt like your band was killing it, but they were like, what do we do?
Yeah.
And you would see them sort of arrange in real time without your guitar in the mix.
Yeah, what's weird is like without the guitar in the mix, it does become a different thing. Like,
it's really weird how that happens, yeah.
Yeah, they can do that, you know. The worst was The View. I played The View in New York, and somehow when the stage came out, slid the stage out for us to play. We'd checked, everything's good. They're like, please welcome. And we were playing Perfect Storm, which is all guitar.
Yeah.
You know? You know? And the solo and all of that, right? Stage comes out and it's live. Go. She was a drink.
No.
She be single barrel. And I'm like, it's not, and I'm trying to get my guitar tech's attention. Whoopi Goldberg sees it. So Whoopi comes up. I take the guitar off and just hold it like this, saying it's not working.
It's not working, yeah, yeah.
Whoopi comes up, takes the guitar from me while I'm singing the song. And like, you know, that girl right there's the perfect, it should be.
Right.
And I'm like, and Randall goes, and he plays the steel solo instead.
Yeah.
And it's a nightmare. I'm on live television. There's no sound coming out. We're having to rearrange it. And then at the end, what's so funny is they're backstage freaking out. It's that Spinal Tap scene where they're stuck in the cocoons.
Right.
And everything's going on. And then at the end, it's like, that girl right there's the
no,
perfect.
And it kicked on. It's right there.
It's back at that point.
It's right there. Does that stuff stress you out, or you yes. go, or it does?
Oh, I was crazy.
Who do you
like,
fire for that? Who do you yell at?
I didn't yell at anybody. I was not happy. My tech's backstage going, I'm so, we found out later, like, I guess it was one of the, like, basically when they rolled it out, the main plug that went to just where the guitar amps were plugged in got unplugged. It was way in the corner, and it, like, pulled it out. It was like some scene from, like, you know, Home Alone.
Yeah, right, right, right.
You know.
I can't even imagine that happens to you, though. I feel like...
That one I remember, because that was like... That's the nightmare, is live TV.
Live TV.
Wireless doesn't work. Cord breaks. Amp shuts down.
Yeah.
Whatever.
There's no track that
you
can just put
in. The most stressful ones I've done have been, like, singing the national anthem at, like, the World Series for the Dodgers. Like,
yeah.
Standing there, I'm checking. I always use a cable and a really reliable... Right. Like, I'll take a Dr. Z that's reliable, that's never broken down, knock on wood. Ready to go. I guess you could just sing the national anthem if it doesn't.
That's
you
true.
Want it to work.
It looks weird. Here's something I've always been curious about, because guitar players know this. It's such a struggle to make your guitar sound good in your ears.
Always.
Do you struggle with that?
Yeah.
And is that, does that piss you off that you have the best guitars, the best gear, it sounds incredible?
We've got it to where it sounds good now. I mean, there's, we've had to hack it over the years, but it's like, the trick is where they sit behind me so I still feel it. Because I play loud on stage and no one can believe that I get away with this, because a lot of lead singers make you stick the amps.
Right.
If you're a guitar player, your amps are like, you know, in the next zip code.
Right.
Mic'd up with glass around them so no one can hear it.
Right.
But the PA. And in my case, I'm like, well, I'm the boss. Mine's gonna be the loudest.
Right.
Like, I'm
no one's gonna tell me to turn him down, basically.
That was fun with Post the other day, because I don't think he's used to that either. So here's my amp sitting there, and he's like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just, like, he came off stage going, where do I buy those? You know, and in that sense, like, with that, we've got a good ear mix going. I've got a couple of mics on it that are good, and I know, you know, it's funny. It's like, you can go through all the mics you want, but the best sounding thing is an SM57 in the right spot on a Vox Blue, and then I've got a Royer ribbon mic too.
Right on it.
On each, on that, and then on another, and then I got a secondary amp. And so there's a combination of like a Vox AC30 or a Z-Rec plus DB4, which is a great amp that Dr. Z made. And those together, out there live, sitting in the right place with those mics through the system, it's great.
It's good.
Yeah.
And then what else do you have in your mix? Do you have the whole band, or do you just do like bass and drums, or what
it's
else
a
do you have? Like?
I mean, basically my monitor guy will bring up fiddle or steel on a solo or something I need to hear, but then otherwise it's kind of just, you know.
It just works and it's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, incredible. What have we left out here? We gotta talk about the paddle. What's the story with this paddle over here?
So this is my bar. You're in my bar.
By the way, yeah, we should say we're in Brad's bar. This place is incredible.
Yeah, there's a whole other wing to it.
Yeah.
But you can see we're stocked. We got major award.
Everywhere. We're right here.
Yeah, it's major award.
That's amazing.
For G-Link. So this right here is my father's paddle, Delta Sigma Pi. Pledges. See that?
Yeah.
This hung in the basement of our house. It says Doug right there. Hung in the basement of our house, and he always said that if I ever lie or steal, it's that.
It's the paddle.
He said, I just won't put up with that. And so I basically, he was cleaning out a big mason jar. And so here's a baseball bat. See it?
Yeah.
He's cleaning out a big mason jar and sets it on the table, and he sees I'm out with a baseball and a bat and I'm playing. And he's like, hey, don't hit anything into that. Like, don't hit the ball like that. I just cleaned it. It's really like a pickle jar, like huge, like really nice glass. I don't know what he's gonna do with it, plant flowers in it or something. And I'm like, okay. And it was me and my cousin Christy, she was 3, I was 5. And I took this bat and it was too much for me. I looked at that jar and I said, what happens if a baseball bat hits that?
Yeah, that's what you thought.
And I'm like, I gotta know. So I took the bat and I just smashed I sent that jar into Kentucky. You know what I mean? So he comes running up the steps of the house. Here's the smash. I throw the bat and I'm just standing there. And he's like, what happened? And I'm like, it fell off the table.
It fell, of course.
He's like, it fell, and he's picking up glass in Mrs. Sarah's yard, like, you know, 50 yards away. And he goes, are you lying to me? And I said, no, it didn't fail. You know, you're experimenting at 5 with what you can get away with.
Yeah, right, of course.
You learn a valuable lesson.
This was a key moment in your life. How much can I lie and get away with?
Some psychologist is writing that as like, we need to talk.
We need to talk,
Especially, we need to talk about your dad's parenting.
So he broke the did he believe you or he didn't believe you?
No, he looked at Christy and said, Christy, is he lying? And she and took off running. And I'm like, Christy, you snitch! So, up to your room. He comes upstairs holding that paddle. And he says, you know, I've told you. That was blatantly lying to me. Bent over. Whack. 3 whacks. I'm crying. Didn't even hit me that hard, but we can try it if you want to see what it's like.
Let's reenact it. That'd be great. No, we can reenact the whole. Probably not. Yeah.
No, that's just weird.
Yeah. But now the paddle's hanging in the bar.
Yeah, so there it is. It's a reminder of what happens when you lie.
Don't lie. It's a great takeaway.
That's the one time I was paddled.
Really?
It didn't take more than that.
You never lied again?
No.
Unbelievable.
That was a lie. Just now.
Just now. That was the lie, mm-hmm. Right. I just think it's crazy. Even this story, that your label at one point screwed up, I think, was it a Grammy nomination? This is how you got the fishing song on the radio.
I'm Gonna Miss Her was on the radio.
This is how you got it on the radio.
It is an interesting, that's a weird one. I guess everything happens for a reason.
Is this?
But it's not a great, like it shouldn't have had to happen that way. So we did the song Two Country. It was Buck Owens, George Jones, and Bill Anderson.
Off of Part Two, your second
album. Yeah, Bill wrote it. And those guys, like, no, Buck had not won a Grammy. When we cut that record, Jerry Hufford, Buck's right-hand guy, called me and said, you're going to be, she said, I just heard it. You're going to be the reason Buck gets a Grammy, finally. And I was like, that would be great. And so,
because he's your hero.
Oh, yeah. One of my best friends became, like, Buck, when he first heard I sent him my album when it was done, before it was out, with a note that said, I hope you hear yourself in this. And Jerry was who called me and said, Buck's heard your record. He has two questions. One is, or he has two things to say. One is, who played all the guitars? And I said, that was me. I played all the guitars. And he went, Buck says bullshit.
Yeah.
And wants you to prove it.
What do you think he would have said if you said, it was Brent Mason? Do you think he would have said, oh, cool, goodbye? Would he have still, he would have invited, do you think Buck told him, if he says the guitars are him, invite him. If he says the guitars aren't him, don't invite him.
He said, tell him, ask him if he played all that. And he said, then tell him I said bullshit.
Yeah.
Right? So he said, come out and prove it. So I flew out 2 weeks later and sat in with him at the Crystal Palace and got to know him and became best friends.
And did you know the Don Rich parts?
Oh, yeah. I was his Don Rich four different New Year's Eves.
Yeah.
Like, I would go every New Year's and just sat in with him. Yeah. Started one year when I was really bored. On Christmas and single and had nobody in my life. And I was like, what am I going to do with New Year's? And had no gig. And I called Jerry Hufford and I said, does Buck need a guitar player? And he was like, he'll lose his mind. I'm not even going to tell him you're coming. So, yeah, so we, went out and sat in and there it was. And then we were just pals and I loved him.
But what was the story with how you got the fishing song on the radio?
Somebody forgot to submit. The way that Grammys work is you have to the label has to submit like what they want considered.
Yeah.
For your consideration, really. And somebody forgot to put in Two Country as a, like they.
Oh my God.
They forgot. And when you miss the window of when it came out.
It's done.
You don't get another, you can't do it for the next year. Yeah. And I was really, and I was frustrated too because I had been begging them to release the fishing song. So I went in and I sat down with Joe Galani and I said, and he was expecting me to tear him a new one. I came, he's like, there's no excuse. I'm so sorry. We have nothing to say except we're sorry. And because I asked him, I said, I want a meeting. And he's like, great, come on in. And I come in and sit down and he's just like, he's going off on why and what, no excuses. And he's sorry and he'll make it up to me. And I said, great. You want to make it up to me? Single, I'm going to miss her. And he's like, what? And I said, that's what I want. Okay.
That did it. And do you really think it wouldn't have happened that way if that didn't happen?
Well, he went down the hallway to Bobby Craig, the head of the promotion. Bobby was great. And Bobby had been adamantly opposed. He's like, "That women are going to hate this. You're saying you're going to fish instead of stick with her? They're not going to like that." I'm like, they do. I've played it since I was in college. They do. They love it. They understand. And so he was like, all right. So he goes down to Bobby, tells Bobby. Bobby's like, well, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with that. And he's like, get it as high as you can get it. And what was so much fun was that we were sitting at number one for a couple of weeks and Bobby got up to speak and he said, this is the most satisfying number one I've ever had. He said, I just did not think this day would happen.
That was going to go.
Yeah.
And you think it wouldn't have never gone that way?
I don't think they would have released it. I think they would have. Yeah. There would have just been too much discussion. I've never been so sure about anything.
Then that song working.
Yeah, because it always did. Like you said, that moment when somebody's never heard it, and you just...
It's
well,
killer.
I love her, but I love to fish.
Right.
You've got them then. It's like, well, I'm going to...
Right. Do you think something I think is so interesting is, you talk about, you've said this a lot, that you waited for your second record to put that song out. You thought that was a second song record.
That today, was written at Belmont. Yeah, that's old.
Today... How many artists even make it to their second record?
I don't know. And by the way, is it really about records too? Like, it's more about what song does what. And I miss that. I miss the fact that it was all about the album thing, which really only happens with major, major artists now, you know, like the Taylors and Beyoncé's of the world. That's about, like, the album comes out, everybody ingests it. You can even, when you're that big, you can even just drop an album and be like, no setup, like, surprise. In our case, it's like, you know, you want to cultivate that and get some excitement, and it's, you know. But I miss that. I miss the fact that it was a physical specimen that you put in your car. And I, every Alan Jackson record.
You had.
Yeah, and even when I was on Arista, before I was new and all that, I would ask for it early, and that Alan album would go in my car, and I would drive out Notch's Trace and listen to every word and analyze it. And, you know, I remember doing that with in college with the album Who I Am, and it just was like, you know, Living on Love and all that.
Yeah. You know? Were you, because I think it's interesting, were you, when you were thinking to yourself, I'm going to miss her, that's a second album song, was there any doubt that, to me, that's almost like, am I even going to get another record? Which obviously the history books.
Tim Dubois and Mike Dungan and those guys would sit me down and say, listen.
You might not get another record.
You got to give it everything you got on the first one to get to the second one. And I said, I believe between what I've got in this first one that I'll get a second record. And I think it's a much better second record when you paint more of the picture that way. Like, and I told him, I said, between He Didn't Have to Be and Me Neither and We Danced and whatever, I feel like I'll get a second record and people will only know part of me. And then you hit them with that. That's another level of like, and that taught me a lot about like what you do going forward, because the next album after that, I realized the first single, I had the code cracked back then, it's different now. But like, it was like the first single off of an album should scream, I've never heard this from him before.
Right.
So the third album, I wrote Celebrity as a first single. I sat
with
down,
the idea.
Yeah, I was like, this is what I want to do. Because you know that's not on the first two albums if you have them. Like, that theme of, like, you know, you didn't miss that on part two. Right. That must be a new album. So that was it. Even more so, the next record, first single, I sat down and I wrote Alcohol. And I was like, and it wasn't until we cut that as a party record that came to life. And I was like, that ought to be the first single. And that was another one where Bobby Craig was like, what? And they went in, and here's a 4-minute song sung from the perspective of alcohol about all the things terrible and funny and everything that can happen based on this. And all the way through to the, you know, the sing-along part of it. And Bobby's like, what am I supposed to do with this now? And that, but you heard Alcohol, you probably remember.
Yeah.
That was new for me.
That type of song.
Sure.
Yeah.
It was like, what is this? Like a 6-8 waltz.
It was very, yeah. But you know, I had that feeling where I thought, what is this with Ticks?
That was that the first album next.
Yes.
First song next album.
To me, I remember first that single. Saying, I've never heard anything.
So you notice
like
the
this.
Trend. It's like from Celebrity to Alcohol.
To Ticks.
To
right.
Ticks. First single was always, and then the first single of American Saturday Night was Then.
Which is a totally different thing from those other ones.
Which you knew you hadn't missed.
Right.
On another record.
Is there a record that you think you're playing really came into what it is? To me, it's probably Mud on the Tires, but does that feel right to you?
Yes,
where you really found your style?
I think so, although I knew what it was in Who Needs Pictures and everything.
Definitely.
But as far as like, oh, now we can do some crazy stuff.
Yeah.
That was Mud, because it's like, you know, like with Mud on the Tires, you can really see that I was really hanging out. Like, I was going out and sitting in with Red Volkart in Austin and, you know, kind of playing some guitar gigs and really going, because on the Mud solo, it's like the, you know.
Yes.
You know?
That's very Volkart.
You know, yeah, and with Red, like, he's on the next record after that. Or is he on that album?
No, he's on,
he's on two different
Spaghetti
things.
Western, or am
Spaghetti
I
Western Spaghetti Swing, Western. And he's also in Clusterplug.
Yes.
Yeah, he was a major influence, because Red's the type, like I said, like, whereas everybody else in a plays a solo like. That's everybody else.
Right, of course.
Red is like.
Right.
Wow, you know.
Yeah.
That's sort of like, you know. You know.
That's what I love. To me, when I was coming up, the thing I loved about Mud on the Tires was I'd gone to this point on guitar where I could listen to something, and even if I couldn't play it, I could kind of know what it was, or you go, oh, it's picking, it's a hammer-on. To me, the guitar on Mud on the Tires, it's almost like a magic trick, some of it. It's like,
well, and
what is that?
And celebrities that, like, like the solos, like this one.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Yes. Yeah, it's like,
that's
what
so
is
stupid.
That? Yeah, but it's great.
It's like a whammy bar solo without one. You know.
Do you ever think about, I know we're running out of time here, do you ever think about how many songs are in your catalog that for other artists would probably be career songs, and for you, because you have these other hits, like there are amazing album cuts that you have that...
That's nice of you. No, I mean, there's a lot that I wish had gotten a chance to sort of...
What do you think? Would you say?
Oh, there's a bunch. Like, let me think about it. Like, every record there's one or two that I'm like, ah.
Like Famous People could have been.
That's great.
A great song.
Yeah.
It is a great song.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting about that is that's. That's a really. That would have been one. Let me think about it. Like every record, there's that, one that got away. I've thought about that too. Like someday.
Like No, I think. Well, I feel like No could have been.
Oh, yeah. That's me and Bill Anderson and John Randall wrote that.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes the answer is no.
Yeah.
When Bill sings it, I've heard Bill sing it.
I barely
heard Bill sing it.
Right, he whispers sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. What did you say? I know we're wrapping up here. I heard you say something interesting on the Smartless podcast, which was...
Really? I said something interesting anywhere.
There was one thing interesting in the whole conversation. It was this. You said that when you felt like when you were coming onto country radio and coming onto the scene, it was a hard time for country artists. The radio wasn't playing new artists.
They weren't.
Is that a trend?
It had been years since a new artist had a number one song.
Really?
Yeah. In fact, He Didn't Have to Be was the first, even though some people had broken through around the time I did, like Montgomery Gentry was doing great, Shadazy was doing great, Andy Griggs, but all of them had a hit that did not go number one. Like, that's how hard it was.
Yeah.
And there's songs that you think of, like, that are iconic songs, like Montgomery Gentry's, like Hillbilly Shoes, and Andy Griggs had You Won't Ever Be Lonely, and it didn't go number one. And here comes He Didn't Have to Be, which did.
Do you think it was a great song? Do you think
that one was special in that it definitely like changed people's lives that had heard it and knew the situation and needed someone to put that song in their life? Like it was just at the number one party, I cried my eyes out because they put together phone testimonials that radio stations had gotten from people. Where it's like, you don't understand, this man has done so much for me and he didn't have to, and this song is everything I ever wanted to say to him, and I played it for him and we danced to it at the wedding, and he's my dad. It doesn't matter that he's not, you know, and it was like, and somebody else is like, you know, he passed away, but I got to play this for him. I mean, it was like this crazy, you know,
it
the
just
things
hit,
that happen
it,
with
it,
songs.
Yeah.
Every songwriter, the gift that you want, that I want for every songwriter is not just success, but you need to understand sometime what it feels like when somebody's story is the story you didn't expect, life-changing thing, all because you sat in a room just like these chairs where we write and had a great time and wrote a song you love and then went and got lunch. And the next thing you know, someone's life is different because of that afternoon you spent with somebody you probably like.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
What more can you ask for?
Nothing. That's the thing about this town that I hope never changes, is that's the songwriting community, and that's what Nashville is. That's how Nashville is different from other formats in New York and LA and Chicago and Atlanta and places that make music. There's such the sort of like team of people that you love. Sometimes it's somebody new. Sometimes it's somebody you've sat with that knows every dirty secret you've ever had. And you sit down and you tell some jokes and you goof around and you write a bunch of bad stuff. And then now and then, here comes the thing that somebody needed.
Yeah.
It's great.
Brad, thanks for inviting us into your home studio right here.
Kidding me?
Can we get another
one? I didn't invite him. I don't even know what.
I just showed up with all this gear.
I show up, here's this guy that like knows too much about me.
Can I ask you about a lick I always tried to learn? And I almost would be surprised.
I don't know that I know it.
I would be surprised. Okay, but it's an idea. It's the second verse of That's Love, you play this swing lick.
Oh man, I don't. That's an album
I had a
cut.
Feeling you would feel this way. I've been trying to learn this lick my whole life. It's the first thing it does to me.
Let's hear it.
I even want to know what's going through your head when you hear that lick, because I'm curious like where that would have even come from.
I barely remember. I mean, we used to play that in the show, but it's been a while.
I love this song.
You are a deep dive guy.
You're going to hear this lick, you're going to go, that's a great lick. Second verse. Here, right.
That?
No. Is that the first verse? That's the first verse, right?
It has to be. That's minute one.
Let me see that. Right here. Nope.
Yeah.
That's kind of it, yeah. That almost sounds like the Rosanna lick or something. Like.
Yeah. I forget. Yeah. You know, it's that.
That's it. Where is that from? Is that like a swing thing or you just made that up?
Yeah, that's basically you're throwing in like you're doing your sort of doing that jazz thing you do where the trick to jazz when you sit in and anything like that is you want to go adjacent to what's right that lands on what's right because you want your audience is always like
right.
A dog with its head cocked sideways like is he gonna land this airplane
right
and it's you know so the easy thing would be. But that's not it, because that's not as interesting. What's more interesting is when you use like the scale from something more like a B. So you're using like. So it's, that's key of E. So I'm really kind of using a D, somewhere between D and B scales. So
right.
You're kind of combining. So D would be, B would be, so you gotta, you know. So you're kind of like going between them, knowing that there's a few notes that you gotta slide into to get there. And that's what the way I think is like, what can I do? Like if I'm just jamming an A, well, what's interesting is like, what if I pretend, you know, this is just modes, but what if I pretend I'm in C, you know, or,
right.
Or G. And you're still in it. And I feel like the Allman Brothers did that. Like,
yes,
you know, when it's,
of course.
Those modes of like Jessica or Ramblin' Man or anything.
Yeah. Where does the Robin Ford influence come into your playing?
You know.
Because he was a big influence, right? Or do I?
For sure, blues wise, yeah. You know, just the way he would milk a note, you know.
Thank you. That to me.
You know, talk to your daughter.
Yes.
That kind of stuff.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. That's so Robin, and that's so you too. Like it sounds so.
That's
much
what's
like
fun about blues and country playing like this is that the same exact notes played by B.B. King and Albert Collins and Robin Ford and Joe Bonamassa and every, they're all different.
Right.
Same notes, and it's like you know who that is. They could you could hand them off. We did a thing here a few weeks ago where I was had a friend over, and Billy Gibbons and Steve Warner and myself. And Zach and a few guys were sitting around and we were putting guitars down on tape in the studio upstairs. And I had this guitar that Nacho Baños had given me.
Yeah.
So I played it and I did this thing on it. And I'm like, you want to do something, Billy? So Billy Gibbons does this thing and it's that. And it was the way he played the note, and then Steve Warner's doing it and it's like.
Same thing. It sounds
and then it sounded
different
completely different, and then Zach, and then and it's back to me, and it's you know like, and it's just different. Like
right.
Every single one, you'd think it was a different guitar and amp and everything.
Right, it's crazy.
And, but that's the fun part about, like making these records over the years. I've been able to sort of like throw in these crazy influences, and still it's still country, like throw in that. Blues or that rock or that jazz or whatever it might be, and you know, just like in Time Warp.
Right, that's you know, that's all of that. You know, right, then, yeah, yeah. When you played that on Letterman, because
yeah.
You did that on Letterman, there's a great video of you doing that at the Ed Sullivan Theater, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then what did you sound with Paul Schaefer? Paul Schaefer,
Paul sat in, yeah.
Sound with your band, right? Sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
The and you guys did what'd you do? Eat All the Fish or
Catch All the Fish?
Catch All the Fish.
Eat All the Fish.
With Eat All the Fish.
Catch
Amazing.
All the Beer.
That's a great video too.
Yeah, that. Whenever I would do Letterman when he was still on and a new album would come out, he would tell me what song to do. Like on that record, what was that, Fifth Gear?
No, that, is that off Time Well Wasted?
Catch
Time
All
Warp?
The Fish?
Oh, Catch All the Fish is off of, might be Fifth Gear. Let's go with that.
So like that would have been, the first single would have been Ticks. And, you know, so you're usually making the rounds and promoting your record with the new song. And he would always write in. And so for like, it was always the jam song. And it would be like Dave wanted to send word that he would like to hear Catch All the Fish. Another one was Mr. Policeman. We did that on there. You know, another one was I'll Take You Back.
Yeah, right, right. That's a great song too.
All those are just album cuts. And he always wanted the Pickin' song on Letterman. So we always did. And I always had Paul set into.
Yeah.
Because I was like, you want to play? He's like, yeah, man, this is some groovy stuff you guys are doing.
Did you have a relationship with Letterman at all? Or he would just tell you what to play? And
not
was,
really. I
yeah.
mean, no. I mean, he would just say, he would get word to us, you know, and then I would talk to him there. But Paul, I knew.
Yeah.
Know.
It's amazing.
Yeah, thanks.
Brad.
Oh, well.
Play us home. Play us out.
What?
I don't know, play us out. I don't know. The
you got an answer. It's your chance. You've been wanting to pick my brain on guitar stuff. What?
The that lick on I would always try to hear that lick on That's Love, and I can never figure it out for
well,
some reason. And now
we
I feel
just
like
did
I got
that, yeah.
We just did that.
How about let's see. Oh, there's also this nugget in Ticks.
Give me a great lick. Give me a lick that I'm gonna go home and watch and learn.
So, Buckaroo.
Oh, it's right in there. It is. That's a Buckaroo. You just dropped that in there.
Mm-hmm. And actually, Jerry Hufford called the day that came out and went,
I've never noticed that.
And went, that's in there, isn't it? I said, yes.
I've never
noticed
that.
Don't tell anybody, we don't want to sue. He said, Buck's not going to sue. Yeah.
Where do you come up with that part on the descending part where you're coming down? How? What makes that weird? Is it the rhythm that you're playing it?
I guess so.
It's such a weird sounding lick,
that is insane. I don't know where I got that. That's my thing. Like that kind of thing. That is definitely.
That's a signature thing.
That's something that I've done. Just sort of like.
Where else do you do that kind of thing?
American Saturday Night. Yeah. Oh, wait, that's not it. Wait, what is it? I gotta think of it. Margaritas in the night, just another night. What's the song? I gotta. Everywhere on Sunday night. All the usually watches up on our shores. This is the one.
Yeah, yeah, that's it.
Yeah,
that's so great. Yeah. Where'd you get that bend when you bend that chord? Is that a Volcar thing, or where'd you
definitely
get that from?
Definitely kind of like Red, yeah.
Red, yeah.
Red will bend the neck, though. Like, Red, these two-piece maple necks are a little harder to bend than an old, like, one of those. But you go, Red will go, and grab his guitar and just, like, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
Very steel guitar.
Yeah.
You know, but he's great at grabbing that. Like, I started the full chord bends a while ago because I was like, oh, this is fun. That was on, like, Celebrity when it was that, you know.
How do you do that? That, to me, has always been a great solo, too.
Yeah. So you just grab behind it and bend up.
Yeah. How do you think, this is such a, you could take this in a million different directions. If you're just going from a one chord to a four chord and you need to lay like a chicken picking type solo or something, what are you thinking in your head? What are you thinking to get from the one chord to the four chord?
What key?
A.
So you mean like soloing up to it?
Like if you were doing a session or something, or playing a song on your record, how would you think about getting from one chord to the other?
Well, I would bend. I would be
bend into it.
Or you could, you know. Just always bends and sort of like that. What are you looking for? Like, weird sounds are the fun part of country
playing.
Of
getting that, yeah.
You know. There's that moment with Post during the I'm Gonna Miss Her thing Saturday where I was playing it, I'm like, and he was like, "What?"
Yes, I saw it. So he was freaking out.
And I kind of threw it on way too thick.
Was that something you were chasing? Like when you were growing up, you were playing like you were playing all these gigs. Did you notice that when you would play a lick like that, the crowd would go crazy? And is that why your guitar playing evolved that way at all?
No, the crowd would leave. My wife's like, "Not so many notes."
No, but don't you think that's what...
I think it's the fun part of country to me.
Yes,
That's what I love about country musicianship is that when you listen to bluegrass, those guys...
Yes.
There's a great song in one of the... I think it might be the EMI catalog. It's You Can't Make Love to Bluegrass.
Yeah.
Can't make love to bluegrass.
Yeah.
But it's that. It's like, you know...
But what is it about this style of playing that you just love? Is it the fact that you kind of get to
I'm
show...
I'm from the mountains of West Virginia. Yeah. It is that. You know.
I would think... If I had your ability, I would love playing this way because it's like you're showing off, but it's so playful. It almost has like a joyousness to it. But you get to show everyone how much time you've spent on this guitar instantly. It just presents that.
And it's, well, to me, it's the, you know, like one of the things my sound man has always said, who I've also had the same sound man since the beginning, a guy named Kevin Freeman, who's great. And, you know, he's like, he sings to get to the solo.
Yeah.
You know, it's that thing. And it's like, that's one of the things that I told somebody the other day that was mixing something I played guitar on. I was like, if you turn that down, I'm gonna kill you. And they're like, oh, I won't. I'm like, no, you don't understand. I know I sang on it and stuff, but that doesn't matter to me.
Yeah.
You better have that guitar up.
It's the guitar, or the paddle's gonna come in.
That's exactly, I carry that thing around.
Yeah.
No, but it's like, to me, that's the fun part of like how, like part of what makes a record mine is that. Like it's gotta, you gotta have a little of that going on. Something that has that thing. And like you said, it all goes back to I got those amps, I started down a path of a sound and there it is, you know. And incorporating, and that's the beauty of this is you incorporate all of these guys we talked about, Buck and Red Volkart and Steve Warner and Vince Gill and, you know, James Burton and
Don and
every guitar player that I meet now that has bought the Paisley Tele and is, you know, ordered to Dr. Z or whatever it might be, it feels like, okay, that lives on. That's amazing.
Right.
And they'll do something new with it, maybe better.
Right. Quickly before we wrap up, what's the current standing of the store? It's doing amazing work.
Doing great.
And it's still doing great, and like where do we go from here? Like, what's the next phase with it?
I think we're talking about like expanding it some. We're in the process of doubling the amount of people served, which is an undertaking, but it was a goal. And that's been great, because I think we're almost there. And then we just had a really successful comedy night with Dusty Slay and John Crist, and we raised 200 grand in like an hour and a half. At Zany's for basically telling jokes and making fools of ourselves. And it's been the most rewarding thing. Such a great way to give back to Belmont too, because like being in partnership with them, what Dr. Jones is doing over there, I say Dr. Jones now and I realize like he needs a fedora, doesn't he? But it's like, it's such a great thing to be able to say, like, Kim's there today volunteering. She's there, you know, she's a better person than me.
Right. We knew that going in. Yeah.
But like being able to leave this also as something that helps the town I live in, because there's so many things you do as an artist that are so far from where you live, but this is a big deal to be able to like help Nashville, which has been the reason I have everything I have and has given me this career, you know, especially that school. As you know, of course I did the Opry night at for Belmont a few weeks ago and called out Marty Crum for the D in guitar.
Is he still there?
I don't think he still teaches there, but I did get I just said, screw you, Marty Crum, and played a song.
Yeah, right, of course.
It was fun.
I love it. Brad.
Thank you.
What a pleasure. Thank you.
You too. You're a great guy. I can't believe it's taken me this long to get to hang out with you.
Absolutely. We'll have to do it again.
We will.
Absolutely.
I'm sure we'll have a new guitar to talk about next time.
I can't wait.
Yeah.